So you and he are in each other's backyard. You've had your license, let's see now. It claims that you last updated in 2009, but my guess is you've had it before that. Is it true, Bill?
That's correct. Technician, I believe, in 2008, and I did the general, last year.
Have you run into N2EO Rich, who's in your town?
Yes, I have. I met him in a parking lot at a local shopping center one time, and I knew it was him. Because I saw his car with all the antennas and his license plate, I believe, had his call sign on it. And I had just gotten my technician license a couple of months before that. And I had a very interesting conversation with him.
To your knowledge, out of curiosity, Bill, are there many hams in Whitestone, or are you and Rich the main ones?
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio. Repeater system.
I'm not too sure how many there are in Whitestone, but at one time there were several individuals who had significant high-frequency antennas on their property. But with the advent of the new technician license over the last couple of years and the advent of rather inexpensive transceivers, you can actually, sit in your living room or den and have a conversation, which is what I'm actually doing now. I don't have an outside antenna. I just have a little mag mount on a windowsill on line of sight. I'm about 2 or 3 miles from the repeater, so I can make it fine. But I do suspect there are other hams in the area.
A simple mag mount on the receiver near the window. You're very lucky, working like a charm. When Rich and 2EO does that, his signal sometimes is a little bit weak. So you've got a very desirable location. John, I know you had some other questions. So, go right ahead. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
One question is, what is your opinion of trying to focus magnetic waves, like from a bar magnet? What do you think that's about? And that'll be my last question for the night. I'll save the rest for next week.
When I've got a bar magnet, and all of those magnetic waves coming out of them, South Pole had to go back to the North Pole, if that's the direction they flow. For the most part, they've got to flow through air. The paths that they have to take are very predictable. You sprinkle some iron filings over a piece of paper that you put on top of your bar magnet, and you can see where those lines of force flow. Or if you buy some of that magnetic viewing material, again, you'll get a picture of how the magnetic lines flow. In order to disturb that pattern, you've either got to change the shape of the bar magnet itself, its length, its diameter, whatever. You've got to change the shape. Or you've got to put materials around it that the magnetic field flows through more efficiently. If you put iron bars around it, the iron bars have a much lower reluctance compared to the air. If the iron bar you pick up has a mu of 10, that's a fancy way of saying that the magnetic resistance is 10 times lower than that of air. So those lines will gather around your magnetic bar, and a greater number of them will flow through the bar than flow through the air. So to some degree, that is doing a kind of focusing. But can you really make a steady state magnetic antenna pattern like you can with a antenna, a phased array antenna, and make it electronically tunable? I think you can. There's nothing stopping you. Let me drop. There's nothing stopping you from making a phased array of electromagnets, and you determine how much current and how much polarity, what polarity and how much current you put through each one of them. Now, let's go to the next step. If I really study what's happening on each individual step of my brushless DC motor electronics that's firing those...
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
When I fire that electronics that is firing my brushless DC motor or my stepper motor, it is making a very predictable magnitude and direction of magnetic field that's present in the vicinity of every one of those circumferential neodymium magnets. You got the 12 coils lined up like spokes of a wheel, 12 electromagnetic coils, and you got 14 individual neodymium magnets on a ring around that. That's for an outring type motor. So as you feed the electronics into those 12 coils, you're determining the exact shape and magnitude of that magnetic field in the vicinity of every one of those neodymium magnets. And therefore you are creating a favored direction of rotation, a favored direction of force, velocity, direction of rotation. You are determining that instantaneous magnetic field by the way the electronics feed those.
Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
So you're determining the exact magnetic field by the electronics firing those 12 coils. There's a similar thing going on with your AC motor, your 1800 RPM motor, which really runs at 1750. Particularly if you feed it with three-phase power. The three-phase power has a particular voltage at a particular time going to three sets of coils. And there is an instantaneous magnetic field that rotates. That magnetic field does rotate at exactly 1800 RPM if you're feeding it with 60 cycles. So there is a deterministic magnetic field that situation creates, and so it is predictable. So you can see now that those two kinds of motors are making a local magnetic field and using it very effectively and moving it in a dynamic manner in the desirable direction and desirable rate. It's kind of different from normal antenna patterns, but it is a kind of antenna pattern. I've never quite looked at it that way before, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, that's good information. What I was wondering, oh, first of all, I need the website, if you know it, where you purchase that material that you observe the magnetic field with, and I need to know, are they different sizes, and what is the size of the one you have, Dick, over to you?
Yeah, they come in 3-inch and 4-inch squares, something like that. I simply Googled the word magnetic viewing material, and I bought it from a site that was on Amazon.com. When you Google the word magnetic viewing material, magnetic visualizing material, you'll get quite a few hits. And there's about three or four different companies on Amazon selling it. And many of them are selling it in the 3-inch squares, and one of them was selling it in a 4x6 square. I think it's a 4x6 square that I bought. I bought the more expensive one. I think it cost me like $10. And unfortunately, it was something like $5 for shipping and handling. But it still is fun stuff to have. And it doesn't do quite the visualizing I expected. I expected it to turn dark when it saw a north pole and bright when it saw a south pole. But that's not the way it works. If it sees a north or a south pole, it turns dark. If it sees the magnetic field parallel to the material, it turns bright. So you still get a picture, but you can't tell the difference between north and south. Over to you, John.
Well, that sounds perfect for the experiment, why I'm talking about the focusing of the magnetic field. If I were to put two bar magnets attracting each other under the dish, I want to see what portion of the magnetic field goes from bar to bar. And does the majority of it leave the opposite ends and go to the opposite ends, or is there interaction in there? That's what I was going to do. So I'm going to look. I hope I can get something bigger than 4x6, but thank you for the information. That's going to help me a lot.
Yeah, I looked for bigger pieces, and I didn't see it. You may have to buy multiple pieces and tile them together. But yes, you take your two bar magnets and aim north of one to the south of the other, there's of course going to be a very strong attraction where they would suck together and slam together immediately. And if you tie them down by some means, that's a non-magnetic tie down, I glue them with something very strong to an aluminum plate, so to speak. And then you wave this magnetic viewing material over top of them. Yes, you will see exactly how many of the lines of force go where. It'll show you that rather nicely. So then you can do the experiment of aiming one slightly differently, changing the spacing between the two, changing the sizes of them. It will give you a pretty good view of what's happening. Now back to you, John.
Yeah, that anything will be better than iron filings because they get to really be messy, and then the magnets get messy too. But thank you for the answers, Dick, and I'm done for the night. I'll just listen. But thanks again, and you too, Mel.
Yeah, Wesley recognized if you've got an extremely high power visual microscope, I think you need power of about 70. And you look at the individual little bitty bubbles that are in this green material, that's the magnetic viewing material, you'll find inside of each little bubble is something like a liquid crystal fluid with a whole bunch of extremely fine things that are probably iron filings. And so whether or not you look at those iron filings end view or side view on each individual microscopic bubble determines whether or not that area of the material is bright or dark. When you look at the ends of the iron filings, you get a dark picture. When you look at the sides of them, you get a bright picture. So that's how I believe it works. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
By the way, Wesley, I have a Princeton Applied Research lock-in amplifier if you need it.
Okay, that's a good news. Dick, I have a question. That material that you're talking about, with the association of the Gauss meter, now you have a visualization, at the same time you have ability to measure the strength of the magnetic field. I wonder what is your comment?
Yeah, the magnetic viewing material has so little material to it that I think it has almost zero disturbance of the magnetic field that it's measuring. I think it's got very little disturbance. So therefore, as you hold the probe of your Gauss meter, maybe it's got a Hall effect device, near your magnets, above the magnetic viewing material, or below it if you like, the nice thing about the Hall effect device plus its Gauss meter is it tells you magnitude of magnetic field, and it tells you polarity. Many Gauss meters have a zero center meter, where it tells you, you know, some number of Gauss to the right and some number of Gauss to the left, and one indicates north up and the other one equals north down, so to speak. So with that magnetic viewing material and the Gauss meter, I think you've got it all as far as quantifying your magnetic circuit. Back to you, Wesley.
Yeah, thank you for the answer. Well, I was thinking that there are both of the devices applied, the material and the Gauss meter. Now you have a visualization and you can follow the path, and then you can make the equal measurement with respect to whatever visualization you've got. Back to you.
Yeah. The only thing wrong with the Gauss meter and the visualizing material is that it's best for looking at a steady state magnetic field. If you've got a rotating magnetic field at 1800 RPM, each of those are going to be much more difficult to use. Not impossible, but much more difficult. I think the magnetic viewing material probably responds in milliseconds, so if you're willing to take high-speed photography of it, I think it'll tell you a kind of truth. And by the same token, I have used a Gauss meter with a Hall effect sensor, where the output of the Hall effect sensor was being displayed with an oscilloscope. So the oscilloscope, again, moved fast enough to tell me what was happening in a dynamic situation. So there are ways that you can make even a moving magnetic field become quantified with these two materials. Back to you, Wesley, K2LIW.
Okay. Thank you for the information. By the way, new development, research, John is going to be surprised as well. I believe I'm moving very, very much in the right direction, and I'm going to update you guys when the time comes. And to Exia.
Hey, John. I hear the sound of another great big purchase. What do you think, John?
I think he's going to have to work another week because I think he's out of money. I know I am right now. I'm waiting for a little bit to come in so I can buy another thing.
You got a little thing like money slow you down? I'm having some fun with you guys. In other words, when you write the check to buy a $1,000 instrument, John, does your hand shake a little bit when you write that check, or do you say, gee, I've done this a lot of times, no problem. Over to you, John.
Dick, money is made to be spent. You don't need, you can't take it with you. You need enough to live, and after that, spend it, because that's what it's all about, whether it be on wine, food, whatever your thing is. I just happen to spend a lot of money on instruments.
KC2, QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I hate to come in off topic, but there's just one question I asked before that you didn't get back to, but maybe, is that I have this little hand scanner here. I've got this, like, 6-inch antenna on it, and it does not perform like any other antenna I've ever seen before. And I've tried multiple other antennas on this little hand scanner, and I've seen these other hand scanners that kind of do the same thing. You know, they go from, like, 50 megahertz to, like, about almost 900 or so, or gigahertz, and just, you know, reception. And the funny thing is, this little antenna tunes, like, from 50 to, like, you know, gigahertz. What's going on here, Dick? Where's the magic?
If you go to the Brown and Woodward curves, Glenn, which are available in every issue of Antenna Engineering Handbook, in the first edition, it's in Chapter 3, in every other edition, the next four editions, it's in Chapter 4. Way back in 1947, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward spent a good fraction of a man year choosing every possible diameter and every possible length of monopole-like antenna above an ideal ground plane. And they plotted for every one of those diameters and lengths, you could say for all possible frequencies that are reasonable, what is the resistive component of the impedance, and what is the capacitive, or what is the reactive component of the impedance of every antenna that you and I can envision. They did it for monopoles, and once you realize that a dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back, you could say they've rated every possible dipole and told you exactly what the impedance is going to be. Let me drop. Now, one possible approach is that little whip antenna on your scanner has an extremely predictable, by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, among other ways, like an extremely predictable impedance, resistive and reactive impedance. And the manufacturer of that scanner could have put in there an electronic tuning network. And nowadays, let me think now, the Peregrine company, among other companies, make a electronically tunable, very high performance capacitor, which I think has 5 bits or 4 bits of resolution in picofarads. You feed the 4 or 5 lines of serial data into it, and it selects an exact number of picofarads. So you could make a beautiful Pi network. And this little Peregrine device is something like, I think it's 2 mils by 2 nano, here we go, 2 millimeters by 2 millimeters is the board space it takes up for this variable capacitor. And you can make a Pi network out of that, that each individual frequency you select has a deterministic impedance of that antenna, and they've matched it. I don't know if they've gone that far, but they could have done that. So therefore, they've selected the impedance matching network for each frequency that you select on that scanner for that particular antenna. You unplug that antenna and plug in some other antenna, it has some other impedance at all of those frequencies that it was not designed for, and therefore the performance degrades. So have you found, when you put any other antenna there, except, let me drop, I suspect if you had a disc cone antenna covering that whole frequency range mounted on the chimney of your house, with a reasonably low loss feed line coming down into that receiver, you're going to get very good performance, because that antenna itself is a gangbuster. But when it comes to the little whip antenna that's on this handheld scanner, I am guessing if you put any other antenna there, the performance is nowhere near as good, because it's not the one that it was designed for. Kind of similar what happens with every one of the handy talkies you and I buy on, say, 2 meters or 450. You go up to the guy that's selling you rubber duck antennas. You say, I want to put a rubber duck for my ICOM. He says, which model number have you got? I said, does it matter? It's a 2 meter. No. Tell me which model number and which brand name. Because each manufacturer has its own way of impedance matching their particular rubber duck antenna. And they've tuned accordingly. Wonder if that helps a little bit. I wonder if that matches some of your experience with this thing, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, you're right on the same approach where I started. And except here's the catch, because I thought that was kind of what was going on, but there's still something else here. Because the radio I'm talking to you on right now, this is an FT-847 satellite radio. This has a receiver, amateur radio receiver, 50 ohm outputs, and I can go pretty much receive on this thing almost up to the same amount of frequency range that my scanner covers. And if I use any of my obvious amateur antennas, they're great within their bandwidth or whatever, and you get a little bit of extra reception out of band, but not too much further out of band. So if I try to listen to, like, police frequencies on this with my amateur radio antennas on here, I can't even hear them. That's how attenuated they are. Let me let it drop for a second.
And when you use the little whip on it, you do hear the police frequencies. Is that what you're saying?
You got it. And then I was like, wait, this is just craziness. So I have my little MFJ, and I mean, it also, it picks up the ham frequencies great from inside the house. And if you touch it with your hand, it really has very little effect on it. And then I took my MFJ 269, the SWR analyzer, and I put it on this thing, and it matches nowhere. It looks like the impedance is open circuit, like all over the place. What in the world is going on with this thing? I, it's a mystery to me right now, Dick. I will get to the bottom of it, but right now it's still a mystery.
Would I be correct in saying that little whip antenna that's on your scanner is way below quarter wavelength in length for almost every one of the frequencies you're tuning it to? And as such, it still falls on those Brown and Woodward curves. Do you believe the antenna itself is a simple monopole, or do you think it's a rubber duck coiled network inside? Maybe you don't know. But still, it sounds to me like they've done a careful job of tuning it for that exact antenna impedance on every one of those frequencies. Obvious by the fact that if you put another antenna on there, in general, the performance degrades. They've tuned it for that particular whip. And for all you and I know, Glenn, they may have used the Brown and Woodward curves to at least find out where the ballpark is before they did fine-tuning. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, obviously, there's, it's definitely working, but it's just such a surprise, because this doesn't match anything that I'm familiar with yet. And I'm sure that there is some kind of additional impedance matching where the, it will work like on here, but it doesn't work on my HT. Now, my HT, the ASU HT, that's got the SMA connector. So when I use the SMA connector to the BNC, which is the same as the scanner antenna, and I put it on there, it doesn't receive like it does. But pretty much all of the radios, like even my FT-736, if I put it on the back of that, it's got like a nice ground plane on it. It works okay. I mean, it receives pretty nicely. So I'm just beginning to wonder, maybe what I needed to do is probably take a plate and put a BNC female on it where I can mount it on a plate and then put it into the tuner, and that might give me a better idea of what's really going on with it, when it's on the scanner itself, it's just like on any other the other radios. It's a gangbuster receiver, and as I said, if you touch it with your hand, it really doesn't affect it. You'd figure, like, with a high impedance antenna, which you'd think it is, it would you know, it would attenuate like crazy, but it just doesn't. It's very amazing. I said, the more I learn about it, I'll come back to you on it and I'll tell you what I found out.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question, Glenn, that once you and I go back twice and get an answer, you may find a little bit of an eye-opening here. Assume I've got a great big sheet of metal, and I've got a quarter-wave monopole, or so-called ground plane antenna. I've got a quarter-wave whip sticking out of a connector that's mounted in the middle of a great big sheet of metal. And where that frequency is quarter-wave, let me pick a number, let's assume it's 30 megacycles. And I do a careful impedance measurement, and I'll find, let me pick a number, 25 ohms of resistive component on the base of that quarter-wave, 72 ohms divided by 2 is 37 ohms. I'll measure 37 ohms of resistive component and no reactants because electronically I've made the whip a quarter wavelength long at 10 meters. And now with that exact same antenna, I go from 28 megacycles, I swish down to 3.5 megs, where it is way too small. And I measure the impedance. I measure the resistive component, and then measure the reactive component. Make me a rough guess as to what I will see with that ground plane antenna, carefully tuned to 28 megs, but I'm making the measurement at 3.5 megacycles. Give me a rough guess as to what I'm going to see, resistive component and reactive component. Over to you, Glenn.
At this time right now, I wouldn't even venture to guess.
Okay. Every antenna that you tune below its resonant frequency, it becomes a capacitor. So you know it's going to have a whole lot of capacitor reactants. The Vizwire is going to be fierce. It's going to be a 150-to-1 standing wave ratio, rough number. You go down to 3.5 megacycles, you're going to see a capacitor reactance of probably 2,000 ohms, and you're going to see a resistive component of about 3 ohms, maybe 2 ohms. In that vicinity. I know that because for the last 6 years in a row, I have lived almost on a daily basis, starting off looking at the Brown and Woodward curve, saying, okay, this is what I'm going to get. You take a look at those two curves, study them for 10 minutes, burn that curve, the general trend of those curves into your mind, and you'll be able to predict a hell of a lot of antennas for the rest of your life, exactly what you're going to get. Whenever you go down in frequency, it becomes a capacitor. Go above resonant frequency, it becomes an inductor until you exceed one wavelength, full half-wave, one wavelength for a full dipole, when you exceed half wavelength for a monopole. Until you exceed that, it's an inductor. And so it's very predictable. Now, in order for an antenna to work well, if you're a naive person, you want it to be ideal 50-ohm load to your coax cable. That's nice if you can get it. Let me drop. There's nothing magic about 50 ohms. The people in Europe say it should be 70 ohms. I could easily come up with a country that says my whole standard in my country is 30 ohms. And you could make a whole society and make a whole lot of test equipment out of that. There's nothing magic about a pure, resistive, resonant antenna at the frequency you want to use it at. Every antenna of every length can be a beautiful radiator if you're willing to impedance match it at that frequency. I'll admit that as your number of wavelengths gets very, very small compared to quarter wave on a monopole, you have to work harder and harder to get a good impedance match. I'll give you that. But it's doable. And once you re-resonate the antenna, that very high capacitor reactance you're going to have at 3.5 megs, in my example, and once you re-impedance match the 2 ohm resistive component, and believe it or not, that can be done with one simple L network, or a Pi network, at a single fixed frequency, I'll admit it's going to be a high Q antenna. It ain't going to be 100 KC wide at 3.5 megs. No way in hell. It's going to be 5 KC wide, 3 KC wide, before you retune it. But still, as long as you're willing to re-resonate it, it will radiate like a charm on transmission. It will receive like gangbusters on receive. There's nothing magic about resonating the antenna itself. You only have to resonate the radiating structure. Antenna, impedance match, feed line, final tank circuit of the final stage of the transmitter. That combination, you resonate it, you'll radiate like gangbusters. I wonder if you believe that, Quinn. I'm trying to give you a faith here. I want you to join this particular religion. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Okay, Jesus.
So?
That was a pentiple. Glenn first, and then Eric in that order, and then we'll pick up all the other guys. Glenn first, go ahead.
No, I do understand that, Dick. You know, believe it or not, it's just that I guess what happens with this particular application of antenna is I'm thinking that something else is going on here. In other words, if I look at my MFJ analyzer, it will measure impedances probably up to about 1K, and then meters off scale. So in other words, anything probably more than, like, say, 800 ohms or so, when I put it on my MFJ analyzer, it looks at it like it's infinity. And what I'm just wondering is that the receivers, because you're not really transmitting, and I think a lot of these receivers, if they had a resonance at like something like 1K ohm or 2K ohms, and it's going into a receiver, but it is a true resonance at a much, much higher impedance, my MFJ analyzer might not see that, but it might be possible at a higher impedance to have a much broader frequency range and then have a bunch of elements inside there to create some kind of like RF rippling effect where they can cover a whole bunch of different bands. But that's what I'm thinking is happening, but it's very difficult for me to measure the actual resonant impedances that are that high, but I think that's what might be happening. But no, I do follow what you're saying, Dick, and I agree 100%. Let me pass it back to you, and I think you got a few more people over there eager to jump in. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to pick up with Eric next. Just to give you a good example of an extremely efficient dipole system running at 915 megacycles, every single little bitty integrated circuit mounted at the center of every single RFID tag, which is primarily a simple dipole antenna. Sometimes it gets some exotic shape, but they are a dipole antenna. Every one of those is receiving enough signal to charge that network and make it work electronically, and it retransmits that signal. Every one of those chips at the center of that dipole is impedance matched to 1,500 ohms plus or minus a little. Every one of those has a fancy looking network that you don't recognize at first that makes the chip see 1,500 ohms, and the chip is 1,500 ohms. A whole industry is based on 1,500 ohms. Nothing magic about 50 or 70. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
I just give you a little food for thought on my end of the world. I have antennas on the tower at work, which is actually a 75 ohm antenna. And it's pretty flat across 12 megahertz. Actually, it's a lot broader than that, but that's all we consider. And don't forget, the transmitters are really at 50 ohms, and the way we make the transition is by actually going from one size center conductor to a different size center conductor. One's actually a little larger than the other. And there's a little hunk of pipe that's a transition. And when you put it on a network analyzer, it's an absolutely perfect match and maintains the impedance across that 12 megahertz within less than a dB. It's pretty damn flat. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, that is a classic approach. It's called a Minerva line. M-I-N-E-R-V-A is the name of the man who wrote the original article in the late 40s, early 50s, on how to do that. If you slowly taper the impedance of a transmission line from impedance A to impedance B, and you do it slow enough in ohms per wavelength, the RF energy doesn't know anything happens. There is no reflection per se. Mr. Minerva invented that. So you can, with the Minerva line approach, start off with a piece of coaxial cable. in which you make a little bit of a slot in the outer conductor, as if you were building a slotted line. And as you go down that cable, the slot gets wider and wider and wider, and eventually the slot wraps all the way around 359 degrees, and you slowly taper from coax cable into 300-ohm twin lead. You got 50 ohms at one end, shielded, unbalanced coax cable, and you got 300-ohm twin lead at the other end. You make that transition slow enough, it will be a 1.1 standing wave ratio at all the frequencies you care about. That's what Mr. Minerva invented. Make the taper slow enough, and the RF energy is blind and doesn't see it. Sort of like putting a lobster in a pot of cold water, and if you heat up the water slow enough, the lobster doesn't know he's being cooked. That's a theory. Over to you for a further comment on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Doesn't work for frogs, just so you'd like to know, W2TTT.
I believe you. You got it, Eric.
You know, you did a great job of explaining it, Dick. And I just wanted to throw that out there just to show the folks that there's many different ways of doing this, similar types of things. But, you know, I've got to have a pretty broadband antenna because I handle two channels that are one next to each other. Actually, the antenna will handle about four channels, but it kind of gets bumpy at the end there. But it's got very low visual. It's actually one of the antennas is a series of both horizontally and vertically polarized dipoles within the radome. And they're stacked, and most people don't realize what was on the World Trade Center on the UHFs, not the VHFs, because the VHFs are bat wings, which is a whole different game. But most of the UHFs were like Channel 31's antenna. I've got video of us taking it apart when we replaced it to put some other antennas in place. It was a series of 140 dipoles, both horizontally and vertically polarized, which is an interesting system how they actually did the power divider for all of those. But that's another story for another day. K2RW, K2J.
100 and some odd horizontal and vertical dipoles. Wow. And all of that has to have a pancake pattern aimed at the horizon or a given number of degrees below the horizon, and it's got to have all of that bandwidth. How in the world was that power division made? Give us a couple of quick words on that one, Eric.
Oh, it was an interesting network on the back of it. You got to consider that the antenna on World Trade, being round, you consider it to be, you know, four faces, but it was actually on a curved platform, was each one of those dipoles had its own individual reflector behind it. And behind that, there was a couple of holes in it that actually fed the leads into the dipole into the divider network. And you can really just look at the divider network as a series of T's. You can think of it that way. And the way ODEV worked out the math, that it worked out to be something like 72 ohms.
How do you make sure that they're all fed in phase? Or maybe they weren't. Maybe there's 90 degrees difference to make circular polarization. Is that what they did?
Very smart. Actually, it was circularly polarized, and that's why both the horizontal and the vertical. Each one being, I think each one of them was exactly 90 degrees apart from each other. And there were two sets of feed lines, one for the horizontal, one for the vertical, and it's all about cable length and placement, or rather, pipe length and placement.
But I've got 70 horizontal and 70 vertical dipoles, if there's 140 total. The top of that radiating mast, radiating antenna, is a lot of wavelengths away from the bottom. As such, when I sweep in frequency, the phase at the top is sweeping much faster than the phase at the bottom. So I can't feed them all in a series string.
Now you should see the coils of wires behind it to compensate, so that way each one leaves at exactly the same phase.
Wow. So it's not fed in a collinear manner like a station master. there's a much more parallel-like feeding mechanism. Is that what you're saying? A corporate feed?
Yeah, and as you move up and down, you'll see that the length of the little feed line, the coils that they use, not coils, a piece of coax, gets longer and shorter according to where you are. You can consider it really as four panels, one facing north, one south, one east, and one west. So you can look at one panel, which is, I don't remember, I think it was something like each one was 30 dipoles, but from top to bottom, I think the thing was about 12 feet. No, it was a little bigger than that. It's been a long time. I have to look at the videotape again, but if you look at the back of it, not only was there individual lengths of cable feeding each one that were different in length, but they also had little capacitive trimmers on them that were set at the factory.
Okay, that's called an equal time delay feeding corporate system. In other words, by various lengths of semi-rigid cable, all coming back to a quasi-common point. And every one of those cables is the exact same electronic length. You could say every one of the horizontal dipoles are all being fed the exact same phase, even as you sweep across frequency. Is that approximately true, Eric?
That's absolutely true. And actually, when you looked at it on a VNA, it was pretty damn good. It was a little bit bumpy. Not like some of the slot antennas that they have, but it's pretty good.
W2TTT.
Go ahead, Doug Gordon.
Yeah, okay, so we've got 70 verticals, 70 horizontals, and they're in four different directions. So forgive me, but 70 divided by four is not a wonderful number for equal opportunity in all directions. Help me with that.
Yeah, if you were dumb enough to bring, if any one bay has one quarter, it's about 35 antennas in it, and 35 of which 17 are horizontal and 17 are vertical, and yes, that's a crazy number, it's close to 16. If you simply put them all in parallel, 50 ohms divided by 16 is a very low number and it would be hard to live with. My guess is that each individual bay had a series of power dividers, 2-to-1 or 4-to-1 power dividers, that came out with a network that fed all of those pieces of semi-rigid cable. Is that approximately what happened, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Right on the money, Dick. There's a series of power dividers. There was one set of power dividers that actually split off. And that another series of power dividers, you know, was done by like row and column. So you got to figure every power divider is 3 dB. So the actual amount of energy going into each individual dipole is quite a bit down from the total. But of course, when you add them up, they add up. I think it was 100. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was like 120 dipoles altogether.
Now I feel better. Okay. Because 140 just is not, a number that, pops out at 8. And where 8 comes from is, divide in half for horizontal versus vertical, and then divide by 4 for 4 quadrants. So it's just like, you had me funneled there for a minute.
Yeah, actually, in the way they had to take it apart with an electric arc cutter, it took about 2 weeks to take the whole thing apart. And don't forget, it's 360 degrees around.
Each of those pieces of semi-rigid cable, were they approximately quarter-inch diameter, semi-rigid? Eric, go ahead.
Well, the thing was fed with a 6-inch pipe to start with when it hit the first power divider and successively got smaller. What was actually feeding the antennas, I suppose, was equivalent to a half-inch cable, something like that.
So coils of half-inch semi-rigid. There are coils on the ones that are near the corporate feed, and the ones on the tips were fed straight out with a half-inch semi-rigid. My guess is that antenna is what? $100,000 brand new?
Now, you've got to remember, this was built by RCA in the late 60s. I've got pictures of the whole thing. So that entire assembly, which was all the stations, it included the bat wing. The thing was over 300 feet tall. You could actually climb up to the inside and change the light bulb on the top. There's a ladder in there.
In today's money, could you replace that mast with all those antennas for less than 30 megabucks?
Well, I know what they spent on the rebuild of Empire. So you got to figure it. Today's money was probably somewhere between 15 and 20 million, something like that.
Oh, you got a bargain. Beautiful. Big money. Okay, we had a quadruple or a pentuple before. Well, who else was making comments on the previous subject? Give me a call. That is right now. KQLIW.
Well, your 2TTT was one.
Okay, Glenn was one. Here we go. Gordon was one. Who was the other?
The VH4YY, just checking in, saying hello.
Hello, Joe. Haven't heard you from some time. So, what was your comment going to be if we had heard you before, Gordon? Go ahead.
I'm trying to remember now. The subject was then, diverted to Minerva lines. Okay, we were talking about, I had two questions. One is simple, one is probably a little less simple. So, first of all, what were those tables called and what reference did they come from? The two names. And the other question was, okay, since they gave you the impedance of a monopole, would one conclude that when it's a dipole that it's what? I'm not sure, actually. The characteristic impedance of that of the dipole using the same basic data tells you what when you make it a dipole using that base data.
Yeah, the people who have heard me say this have done many times before, Gordon, are going to be a little bit bored by this. But I'll try to give you the compact version. I got a dipole in free space. At one instant of time, I'm feeding the right-hand side positive voltage. And at that exact same instant, the left-hand side is a negative voltage. That's the way I'm feeding it. And a half cycle later, everything is reversed. Down the center, there was a neutral plane. I could put a sheet of copper at right angles to the dipole, right down the center, and nothing would change because it's in the neutral plane. You have positive to the right, negative to the left, there's neutral in between. So that infinite sheet of metal doesn't matter. Once the sheet of metal is there, I can decide, hey, I'm not going to use the left-hand side of the dipole. I'm only going to use the right-hand side and the sheet of metal. You and I call that a monopole or a ground plane vertical antenna. And in theory, it's got exactly 35 ohms in the center. That's what a monopole is. So a dipole is two monopoles back-to-back. The Brown and Woodward curves, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, 1947, did a good fraction of a man-year of work measuring all possible diameters and lengths of monopole antenna. Measured the resistive and reactive component. Let me drop. And the Brown and Woodward curves are in Chapter 3 of the very first Antenna Engineering Handbook, McGraw-Hill, 1960. And all the later versions, the edition 2, 3, and 4, they're in Chapter 4. You go to Chapter 3 of the first edition, Chapter 4 of any edition of the McGraw-Hill Antenna Engineering Handbook by Jasek and Johnson, or I can't think of the damn guy's name for the latest edition. Here it is. Philakis. But you just look up Antenna Engineering Handbook, go to Chapter 4 of any of the later editions, and very soon on page 3 or page 4, you'll find the Brown and Woodward curves. Every possible monopole / dipole you are ever going to build is on those curves. Therefore, you know the exact impedance your antenna is going to be, even though you're on 1/16th of its operating frequency. It's all deterministic. You know exactly what impedance matching you've got to do. Once you impedance match that crazy impedance, it'll radiate like no tomorrow. The infinitesimal dipole is what Krauss said. If you know what he's saying, on his infinitesimal dipole chapter, paragraph, of his original book called Antennas, 1950 McGraw-Hill, the infinitesimal dipole will give you 95% efficiency, I am saying. You may not like the impedance, but it will radiate like crazy if you're smart enough to impedance match it. Over to you, Gordon, KQLIW.
Okay, I got it. I'm good with that. And what about differences in materials and affecting the resistance, the radiation resistance? How does that enter into the equation?
Before we go there, when I take a full half-wave dipole on 80 meters, 132 feet long, nice and high in the air, and I decide to build a miniaturized version of it, instead of building it 132 feet long, I build it 5 feet long. And I go to the Brown-Woodward curves and I find out it's got a fierce impedance, 5,000 ohms of capacitive reactance and 1 ohm of resistance. And that might be the real number. But I resonate that. I impedance match that. And it radiates with 95% efficiency, and the 5% I lose is in my impedance matching network, the dipole itself. If I radiate a whole lot of power, I'm going to get high voltage, and I might arc it over from tip to tip, but I'm careful not to go that high in power, and it radiates like a charm. With that antenna that's 5 feet long instead of 132 feet long, make me a guess by good common sense, Gordon. What do you think is the effective capture area of that antenna when I am receiving? I'm going to compare the full 132-foot dipole, 80 meters, to one that's only 5 feet long, but I probably impedance match. What do you think is the effective capture area on that tiny one compared to the original? Over to you, Glenn, or Gordon.
I was going to say the ratio of their squares.
Good common sense, dead wrong. They're almost identical. The fact that you have resonated it, the fact that it radiates with 95% efficiency, it's got a slightly broader antenna pattern than a normal dipole. Therefore, it's got a little less than half a dB less gain broadside. Not loss in power, loss in gain, because the pattern became a little bit broader. Except for that half a dB, it's actually 0.4 dB difference. Except for that, it's got the exact same effective capture area on reception. If you believe in the law of reciprocity, and it is a hard, fast law, however an antenna transmits, pattern, efficiency, polarization, gain, polar emission, everything, whatever it does on transmit, by the law of reciprocity, it has the exact same characteristics on reception. Therefore, its effective capture area did not change. That's the magic of resonance. That full half-wave dipole is 8,500 square feet of effective capture area. That tiny little dipole, instead of 8,500, is going to be 8,000 square feet of effective capture area. If your eye operated at 80 meters and you looked at that little dipole, you would see the exact same great big oval in space, of black material, that 80-meter antenna, 80-meter signal getting into that area, gets sucked up by that antenna, goes down that transmission line, and moves that S-meter. Ain't that crazy? Of course that's not common sense. I can prove that. And I don't blame you for being damn skeptical. W2TTT, K2LIW.
Okay, so much for the notion of size matters. Very good. All right, well, we have other people with questions behind me, so I could go on forever, so I'll be a good boy and let you move on. This is, from the previous dialogue, I sensed that that's where you were going to go, but man, now, ratio of the squares came to mind, but okay, I get it. Very good. We live, and, you know, I'll work on that 6-foot 80-meter antenna, or 10-foot 80-meter antenna. KTRAW, thanks, W2TTT.
Tell me once again, Mel, the name of the guy, the engineer from Bell Laboratories, who had a whole series of articles in QST Magazine, W2FM, his name in call letters, you know the guy I'm talking about, who made a whole lot of small ground plane antennas in his backyard, wrote a whole series of articles in QST. What's his call letters and name? Over to you, Mel, if you're still awake.
At W2FMI, Jerry Siddick. Oh, he had antennas. Boy, oh boy, he was really into it, Dick. Great guy. and wonderful gentleman. Go ahead.
I could have answered that. W2TTT.
Good old Jerry Siddick, and I was on the same dais with him once at a IEEE presentation on electrically small antennas, and he proved it. As long as you use the right impedance matching devices, some very small antennas give you essentially full performance. If you didn't re-resonate it, the smaller antenna you would use square law to figure out how much the signal falls off, it's a lot worse than that. If you don't resonate it, it falls off extremely fast, faster than square law. You re-resonate it at each frequency as you go down without changing the antenna's physical size, and you keep coming back to the exact same performance within half a dB. And the half a dB you can explain as a slightly fatter dipole antenna pattern. Hey, we've kept these guys up awful late. 73, you all. This was TechNet number 1327. We'll be back next week. Try to settle some of these issues. Try to be kind to each other. Don't holler at each other. Hey, Mel, give us your comments on all of the above. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'll tell you something. It's been quite a life with ham radio technology, and we still get amazed. That's the bottom line. Talking about loop antennas and things like that. You remember some of the old radios? I remember we had a Zenith radio, old console, 1930s. And it had an antenna, a loop antenna in it. You turned the knob and the antenna turned. Amazing. And there you are. So we're still basically doing the same thing. Talked about mechanical filters. Holland put the mechanical filter together and designed it back in the late 40s, early 50s, I believe it was. Still around. There you are. So be amazed, huh, that sometimes we're not as ancient as they say. My daughter loves to call me a dinosaur. Anyhow, good night all. Catch you all next week. Stay well and have a great week. This is K2KEY.
Dick? Dick? Hey, you're almost saying, Mel, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We keep inventing new techniques, but some of the old ones work like a charm. Go ahead, Wesley.
I couldn't resist to give you the last comment. Can I tell you one thing? Power of the word. There is a small spark and creates a big fire. And I remember quite a good few months ago when you started to talk about the Smith chart. And I decided that I really want to have a network analyzer. And I didn't even think that I'm going to go that far with the free energy project, whatever. Now, John purchases a new device just because you highly recommended the value of this stuff. Now, you're real educated for me, and I do thank you very much. You did a lot. I believe a lot, not to only me, but many people. And to Jay.
You're too, TTT.
Yeah, thank you for the compliment, and the majority of the letters that Mel and I get are fairly positive. There's a common denominator in them. This guy, R.I.W., man, is he verbose. Go ahead, Gordon.
That's okay. You know, as I said earlier, my son was grinning when I mentioned that sometimes I'll do as you do and give a longer answer to a question and bore the hell out of my sons or whoever else is unfortunate enough or fortunate enough to their viewpoint about it. But so be it. You got me thinking. You know, I have a very small lot, and I'm wondering now if I could have, I do have a very tall mast on top of one of my towers, so if I could place a tuner at the feed point and have a way to control it to provide a match at the feed point, I could have a 40 meter or 80 meter dipole that would be electrically matched 50 ohms be resonant, and you have a good match of 50 ohms right at the feed point. And, taking something simple like an ICOM AH4, sticking at the end of my masted tower, would allow me to have a